Hi, everybody, and welcome to Lost Explorers, episode 190. My name is J. David Osborne, and that is Chris Sacknessum. Chris, how are you doing this evening?
David, I'm so excited that we're at 190. We started this off so humbly a long time ago, and I think it's really something that we should remind listeners about, that just stick to the program and follow one step at a time, and you do create a great body of work. It's not necessarily always great. That's the nature of artistic and intellectual work. But I think it's very exciting that we've achieved this level of continuity, and I'm very grateful to you and our listeners for it. We thank you. We're going to keep rocking on because there's more to explore.
Absolutely. Yeah, feels good. Getting close to 200. Well, I'm excited to talk to you this evening. Do you have a band for us and an aphorism?
Okay, the band idea, and with David's and listeners' permission, I'm going to actually play at the end of the show our latest piece. But it's the idea is William Burroughs and the Fungus People. And the I where it came from is I love a mashup of William Burroughs and Edgar Rice Burroughs, Tarzan and the Ant-Man. I love that kind of weird thing of some sort of acid drug head gay guy mixed in with a 1930s pulp writer. I think that's a weird, nice mix. In my little fantasy behind the piece is that William Burroughs, who actually did go to the Amazon to seek the drug Yajé, hallucinogenic vine, in my scenario, he discovers an ancient spaceship and manages to enter the spaceship. And when the mutants who have resulted from the interbreeding of the aliens behind the spaceship and ancient indigenous people return and find him in control, they naturally think that he's a god. And therefore, he then faces the question of, well, whether he will be worshipped as a king, human king, or whether or not they're going to sort of dissolve him with poisonous mutant acids and strange chemicals and absorb him into their community that way. Meanwhile, just by entering this ancient spaceship, he has triggered alarm systems around the world. So, therefore, all of the national forces that exist with military intelligence and hardcore, people jumping out of black helicopters, they all descend on the Amazon, and things are not good for Bill. It's a little bit of a tough time. So it's a fun kind of song. I think it's some of our best percussion, but I like the idea of William Burroughs and the Fungus People, as opposed to Edgar Rice Burroughs writing about Tarzan and the Ant-Man. I like that book. That's a really great book, by the way. If people haven't read that, I think it's really interesting because it has a weird Ursula Le Guin flip on sexuality and gender. It's very, very interesting. There was more going on with Edgar Rice Burroughs than meets the eye. So that's my band. And
Very
here's my
cool.
aphorism. And I was thinking about this. I do a lot on my marimba, which is in the background here. I encourage people to seek out ways to make sound while they're making sentences as a way of finding sentence structure. If matter matters more than anything else, why can't you hold water in your hand? And I made that on the marimba. I let the notes actually determine the words. And I think that's an interesting idea for writers and thinkers to seek out some sound guides to creation of semantics, you know? If matter matters more than anything else, comma, why can't you hold water in your hand?
That's very interesting to think about that for a second. If matter matters more than anything else, why can't you hold water in your hand? So the connection to sound is what?
Well, there's a matter and water, a connection there. So there's a kind of a balancing in the sentence structure. I mean, I think the idea is that matter is a very controversial idea. We have it as the essence of physics and chemistry, physical science, materialist science, which you and I take a great deal of prosecutorial attention to. And if that is so important, well, then why aren't we all just at one with matter? You know, in
I
fact,
see.
we're actually lost in very immaterial things. I mean, most of our attention is really to the invisible, the immaterial, the metaphysical.
This definitely tracks with where my head has been at this past week in a very Lost Explorer's way, thinking about how by doing something counterintuitive, you reach the actual either problem or solution that you're looking for. And I do think that this focus on matter is a sort of cosplay or LARP on the part of people, because we are more and more separated from material all the time. What we're in is a kind of it's anti-spiritual. You know what? This is a big key, I think, that your aphorism has unlocked, because we often do rail against the materialism and the anti-spiritual, right, on this show. But I think the truth of it might be is that we're both anti-spiritual and anti-material. We're neither. I mean, I think that, well, because, a real spiritual person, they all have altars with sacred objects. So it's just the removal of the sacred from the material. It's a very superficial interaction with the material, perhaps. So I like that. I'll think about that some more, but that one definitely got my gears turning. Every once in a while, you'll throw one that doesn't make sense to me immediately, but it always comes around.
Well, thank you. And I think you've added a lot of value to that idea, the desacralization of both the material and the immaterial. You always really help, I think, people make more sense of things. And I appreciate it because you always help me make more sense of things, you know? So
Yeah, of course.
this is kind
It's
of
a good
what
system.
This is what our real message is to listeners, is that if we interview each other, if we listen to each other and interact, we can really help th advance thinking in a really deep way and make more sense. W sen you know, making sense, that's an odd idea, isn't it? We don't find sense, we don't just experience sense, we make sense of the world. And I think we make sense of the world together. So, thank you.
Don't let me forget about sense, because I want to start off our main body conversation with that word. Before I do that, though, what is my imaginative challenge for today?
Okay. I think this is going to be really fun. I don't think that you get high anymore, but I want you to put your good old Philip K. Dick stoner hat on
Oh,
again.
that's where I live, man.
Yeah,
Yeah.
okay. Because this is a,
I run the underground, guy.
well, this is a Philip K. Dick sort of stoner idea. We've got an expedition launched into space of 20 males, 20 females, and some of them may identify in different ways, but
Okay.
we've got some people. We've got some people. This is not just a small group, but they are in suspended animation, sent off deep, deep space. This is our human effort to reach into the deep future, the far reaches of space. They are in suspended animation for a very long time. And you can be sure they're going to be healthfully, maintained. The one problem is this: hackers have influenced the programs that they're experiencing. The idea was that in their deep space journey, they were going to be absorbing all of the human knowledge that has ever been produced. The great works of literature, the great works of art, the great moments of science. They were going to be fully enriched across time. No. A small group of hackers reached in and changed the program. We're not sure exactly which members get which program, but there are two in play. For thousands and thousands of years of space travel, one group is exposed to every single frame and moment of the view. Another group is exposed to every single frame and moment of the entire Law and Order franchise. But everything comes to an end, and they do arrive at some point, and you will get to decide if it's still in space or if it is in another galaxy on another planet finally. But we're talking thousands and thousands of years of endless replay of these two programs. And you're going to tell us what happens when Spaceship Earth finally does arrive somewhere. And these humans, and they are humans like us, they're still maintained. They've been maintained beautifully, but they've been exposed to not the wonders of Western and world civilization, the great moments of literature and art and science. Nope, they have been exposed continuously to the view and to the entire Dick Wolf Law and Order franchise.
Good one. I like it. Common sense. There has been a kid in the school who has been graffitiing the word common sense all over, in the bathroom. He's driving our janitor insane by sharpieing this. It's been written on my board. So it's very likely one of my students, though I don't know who it is.
Oh, wow.
But this graffiti spree is one of the great trolls that I've ever seen, ever. And it's because they change one letter. The second S in sense is changed to a C. So it is spelled Sence. And it has slowly been driving everybody crazy. They're not even mad about the graffiti anymore. Everybody is extremely disturbed by this misspelling. And I don't know who the kid is. I don't know if they just didn't know how to spell sense or if it's on purpose, but it's one of the most brilliant trolls that I've seen in its ability to just warn. It's just, it's off, man. It's off. And I do think what I've noticed by people who've seen it, because I've seen kids and teachers alike encounter this graffiti and think, but that's not how you spell it. Well, go wait, Google that. Why did they spell it with a C? Like, wait a minute. How, why did they?
Why
Why
did
did.
they, as opposed to,
Yeah,
it
yeah,
becomes a communal act, It's
yeah.
like communal terrorism, asymmetric
Yeah. Yeah.
approach,
Why did they do this? And what it unlocked for me about the best gags, pranks, and trolls in human history is that they do have that subtle ability to just make people introspect for a moment. And I think that that's where a lot of the discomfort is coming from. I think that people spend a lot of time not dealing with what they actually think about things. Okay, so you see a lot of people overcompensating for that on the internet and not dealing with their feelings about things. And this simple little phrase, and it's funny that it's common sense, by the way, right? Something that we're all supposed to have, and that you would think the phrase itself, common sense, if you had common sense, would be spelled correctly. But it's just absolutely leaving a trail of destruction in its wake. So my hat's off to whoever's deciding to do that. Common sense. MacArthur High School, 2024. That's
I kind
our
of
motto
love
for the
that.
year.
I love that. A Highlander going crazy, It's
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. Berserker mode.
breaking heads. Well, you have to think that that's more interesting than inventing a new app,
Yeah. Less
Wow.
lucrative, but more interesting.
I hope that the responsible individual is in your class and has derived some inspiration from your mania,
More than likely, that's the case. More than likely, that's the case. I've been told several times that by some kids, you're not the best teacher I've ever had, but you're the most interesting. And I say, okay, I'll take
There you
it.
go. There you go. Yeah.
But yeah, so what would you, we talked to Matt O'Brien last week, great
We
guest.
did.
We've been talking about story listening. I will now turn it over to you. What would you like to talk about in the main
Did you
body of
get
the
my
show?
notes? Did you get my notes?
Did you email me notes?
I did.
Wait a
I
minute.
did.
Wait just a damn minute here. I thought you didn't send anything to me. Hold on. I will look them up and I will read them.
Okay.
From February. Oh, here we go. Got them. Okay. So this will
Okay.
be really good. I'm completely unprepared. So
Yeah, all right. Good. 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 Well, that's good. On the back foot,
Yep. Okay, here we go. If people haven't read Jung's work on flying saucers as modern myth, I recommend it. I hadn't looked at it in some time, but I think it reads even better in this age of social media. He completely skirts the issue of real or imagined and focuses on the sheer popularity of the mythology. This is the view I took of cargo cult beliefs when I was a failed young anthropologist in Melanesia. Real slash unreal misses the point if something is deeply vivid at the social level. Jung's short book makes a nice pairing with Randolph Stowe's remarkable novel, Visitants, which we have talked about on the show. I'd have to go back and see what
Yeah,
episode
we
we talk
have.
about that novel, which is set in the Trobriand Island during a UFO cargo cult crisis. Stowe was a young patrol officer, and the book provoked a nervous breakdown of lifetime impact. You can see why. In something like Melville, the strangeness starts early, and then Stowe takes you right off any map. Okay, so really quickly, I think that this is one of the major points that unlocked magic for me in general was Jung, and that stepping outside of the real unreal dichotomy into a third thing. I think that when people say, but is it real or is it true? They're completely missing the point, which is also my approach to conspiracy theory. It's
Right.
really hard for people to get their minds around this, but the least interesting thing about a conspiracy theory is whether it's real or not to me, whether it's actually factually correct. Instead, this idea of the popularity of it, the evocative nature of the myth, being a strange third thing, where it is both kind of true and both kind of untrue. But even using those words as designators doesn't really help us at all. So right off the bat, I like that.
Well, I think that's an important thing. This is the essence of what Jung was about, and I think it's the basis of my new approach to what I call phenomenal analysis, not critical analysis, which I think has become very boring and is really, the word critical now just says, well, power structures, who's in charge, who's in control of something. I think the first thing is that we need to acknowledge the sheer existence of belief, and why are before we get to thinking about why people are involved in it, let's just accept that what's going on is of substance, and let's have a phenomenological threshold of belief. And I think there are many ways to think about this. I mean, I've been thinking again about the whole world of porn. I mean, you don't need to make a decision about is porn good or bad, or you just forget all those value judgments. Let's just look at the level of social engagement with this. And let's look at social engagement with any idea first. We don't need to make a, I think breaking into value judgments is, well, for starters, I think that's chasing your own tail, or chasing woozles, as you and I first started talking about in a Winnie the Pooh sense a long time ago, where we're really just following ourselves around and around a thicket. The more important thing is this anything a social reality of any kind at all? We don't need to fact check it. We don't, I mean, that's kind of a very odd idea, actually. UFOs are a really good example. They're not going away, they're not going away. And I think if we engage in this anthropologically and start seeing this, this is what I learned from the cargo cult days back in Melanesia. There doesn't need to be an explanation of why. There needs to be an engagement of how.
Yes. Very important. That is so, and again, cargo cults and magic are, you can't pull them apart
No.
because magic is a cargo cult. Spells are cargo cults. Magic is entirely concerned with the how of it. If you're performing the Abramelin, nobody knows why it works. And the good magicians, rather, are not interested in why it works. Is it all psychological? Is it, this is when magic becomes very, very boring once you start trying to figure out why it works. But the how is the fun part. That's what makes magic, in a sense, such a fun, tactile, almost carpentry level exercise, is that it's all about the how. How do you do the Abramelin? Well, here are the instructions. Don't worry about the why. You'll see what happens.
It's funny you mentioned carpentry. I've come back to that in the last week as a crucial word. I think it's just, I think we forget that. And those of us who, weren't necessarily raised with that skill, the idea of carpentry and like making a birdhouse or something, sent that very physical, tactile idea of the how is really where all the action is. And the why that's significant. I mean, no one's actually asking that question, are they really? No one is really asking why magic or porn or weird stuff is interesting. We
No.
really don't ask that question.
No.
So it's the it's the it's the ability to dig into some of the mechanisms of these things that are so important. And then I go on to say that I think that, strangely enough, this revisitation of Jung and Randolph Stowe's wonderful book, I really love his work. I don't know if people have followed up this recommendation, but he was a great Australian writer. He's actually a British writer. He did pay a lot for this wonderful book, Visitants, which I think is a pretty stellar novel, a mid, 20th century novel that is really hard to come by. And he did retreat to England, kind of permanently broken. Some of his work is really fantastic. He was a very interesting gay writer. He went out on the limb to be in very remote, difficult, physical, masculine situations in the Australian Islands and then the Trobriand Islands of New Guinea. He's a weird, weird dude. I really have a lot of respect for him, and I think his writing is just testimony to itself. But I wonder if this doesn't tie into, if this may just be me, but I think this ties into the larger phenomenon of our time of representation versus reality and representation as reality. I was thinking again about Schopenhauer's ideas put forth in the world as representation and will. And anytime you mention a German writer and you got, you start to think, okay, well, we're in heavy, intellectual territory. Maybe we are, maybe we're not. I would rather think that Schopenhauer was interested in the question of the human construction of reality. And that got me thinking about very, in very popular terms, which we've all heard about, Google, their Gemini AI image generator things. Have you seen any of this stuff?
I
It's
have, yeah.
absolutely ludicrous. I
Yeah.
mean, I laughed my head off. We have black popes, black female popes, black Vikings, which I think do kind of look sort of cool.
They
I
look very cool.
do.
They look very cool. That to me, I'm sorry to interrupt, but there was a British television program about Vikings and they included Black Vikings in there. And of course, stupid people who have nothing better to complain about were complaining about that. And I saw the pictures and I thought, well, yeah, but it looks cool. Again, real and unreal, insignificant. Who
I agree
cares?
with that totally. I think though that what we've got is a an obvious, case of a company and an AI program working on a very, very strict agenda that is generating images that are problematic for multiple reasons. I mean, I think when the CEO apologizes that there's some interesting things going on there. But my point is that the larger and deeper issue is that we're now so embedded in a world where image alone matters. And I just remembered and rethought and reread some of what Schopenhauer was involved with in the world as representation. And I realize how fucking pathetic we've become. He had a much richer idea of the notion of representation as a verb form, as a cultural human species activity of imagining and creating the world. And it was continuous and it was deep tissue. It was not on the level purely of surface and image, And this is what we've degenerated to, And I think that that is really I mean, it really makes me grieve for where we are. I think that we have fallen away from light, as some really good writers would say. And I don't know why that necessarily needs to be the case. Representation now, in a woke sense, means simply faces in the places. It means a completely optics approach to everything. And we've talked about this before, but I rediscovered the Schopenhauer point of view that representation actually was a very constructed, absolutely constructed human endeavor of great cultural depth and sincerity to formulate a world, to formulate a world in which we could participate. And what we've now gotten is just an agenda-driven idea of ridiculousness that should be laughed at by everyone. And well, some people can laugh, but it's also kind of out of bounds in our woke society that you can't really, this is the way we break down stereotypes. And the bigger problem is, no, that's not really the issue. The problem is that we're now addicted to a very superficial level of imagery that denies substance and truth. That's my concern.
It's interesting that AI is showing that to us in the way that it is,
Yes.
because AI generations are just iterations of things that have come before. An
Yes.
algorithm parses data and then iterates, 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 iterates. Even in the process of creating, it's just constant iteration. It's a probability that the AI is doing to try to see what would most likely come next. And it's drawing data from, well, supposedly all of our internet searches, but more than likely our most recent ones. I'm interested in this idea of representation as an idea that sort of shapes the world. And the idea that now, because I feel like a lot of people would say that the reason why the kind of superficial representation that you're talking about is important is because it shapes the world. And if you want to shape a world that's better, you would do it in this particular way by showing different types of people, different colors and body sizes. But I think what it gets down, the part that people are missing, is that you and I are not racists. And so we do not wish to represent the world in terms of skin color or body type, or we're looking at the inner life of people. We're interested in a representation of different types of thinking, imagination, different types of imagination. What about diversity of imagination? That's an interesting thought, right?
Well,
But go ahead.
this is entirely lost in this debate because we were entirely at surface level. But just to intercede for just a moment, I think that you and I have a great deal of problem, philosophically and practically, with a representation of the world. Terms of human faces and body forms. I mean, that is only one tiny part of the world.
It's the thing that's cool to look at and literally nothing else.
I don't even think it's cool to look at. I'm offended by the notion that the entire universe, existence, all of life, all of possibility. When we currently know that our best scientific minds, going back to our scientism program, our best scientific minds say that we know something on the order of 20% of all of the biomass that has ever existed. We know nothing about really the organismic capability of this planet. And yet we are now focused exclusively on the extreme social human element. I have
Human is the key
revelations
word,
that.
right? Human is the key word there. I see where you're coming from now, definitely. That it's myopic and we're focused on us when there's so much other stuff that we could potentially be interested in philosophically, scientifically. No, I totally get that. I
And
totally get that.
maybe
I
for our own survival's sake, I had the big moment today. And all big moments are quiet moments, aren't they, really? I thought to myself, social media. Jesus, we hear that term all the time. I heard. Selfish media. And I think that is the reconfiguration of that whole idea. I think this is, I think we are dealing with a radical program of agendaizing everything and ideology. The ideology program is so deep, and yet it reinforces the human selfish, not social. Human-centric
Oh, interesting,
concept.
interesting, interesting. Yes, yes, yes. I love that. That's so interesting because it makes total sense from a motive perspective. If you want a society that's full of navel-gazing consumers that don't think very much, you want to reinforce the selfish as much as possible. And there are two tracks that you can go on there. One of them is much more obvious, which is to focus on the self, self-help, self-care. Focus on your trauma, focus on, building yourself up. Quiet down your thoughts, make sure that yourself is well maintained. But the other one that appears to be different, but in your estimation is actually the same, is this focus on the other in terms of different types of bodies and skin tones. But it never really ventures outside of the self because when we're looking at those representations, we're reminded of ourselves through the difference. Whereas we're not reminded of ourselves necessarily through the difference when we look at a squid or when we're talking about the depths of
Well
the
said.
ocean
Well
or
said.
the tops of mountain peaks or whatever. We're not, that's what the sublime really is. The sublime is when we're taken out of ourselves by the incredibleness of mountaintops and the depths of the ocean and the strait. Gus and I went to the aquarium a week ago and we saw a dead giant octopus in
Oh, wow.
formaldehyde. It's very cool and also very creepy to see one up that close. But it didn't remind me of myself, not even a little bit.
Well, I think it's really important to maybe just trailhead marker that word sublime for, I think we need to recoup that and to think about that forward looking. This is the question. This is the question. And it's something that someone as young as Gus could get with. I think we need to be in touch with the sublime and to really look at the etymology of that word, which is very interesting. Sublime, anything really? Okay. Yeah, sub, right. I think that's a really, really important idea because we are getting to a point where we are on such an anti-sublime frequency in popular culture where everything is entirely human-centric, entirely ideologically driven or identity politics driven, or it's so human-based. And yet we know that that is a complete Well, it's a box canyon, isn't it?
It's a box. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This is a huge idea. Going back to Kant, people need to reread Kant because Kant's big
I agree.
phenomenology, what can I know outside of what I can actually perceive? And the sublime is a big part of that because the sublime confronts you with something that is so not you that it fills you with a feeling of fear, awe. Kant, Lovecraft, maybe that's why people, in spite of his, his controversy over his racism, why people still are fascinated by Lovecraft, because Lovecraft really kind of cosmic fear is the other side of the coin of the sublime, something so different. And people often say that, the reason why Lovecraft is so scary is that, it shows that there are these huge beings out there that are completely unlike us, that don't care about us, that, we're very small in comparison to that. That sounds to me a lot like the sublime, just the more tentacled, frightening version than like standing on a mountaintop or something like that. But if you take the fear element out, the horror element of it out, maybe the reason why people enjoy that is because nothing gives them the feeling of the sublime when they're scrolling the internet. It's impossible. You can't get it. That is a, that is an experience that you can only get through actual lived experience. I've never once felt the awe of the sublime. I have felt the feeling of the liminal and the subliminal, but not the sublime. Different things.
I just had an insight into, I mean, one of my dreams is that you and I would do a workshop, either virtual or real, at Esalen Institute in Big Sur. And I just had an insight as to what that might be. I really love the idea of relating our notion of the sublime as kind of being, introduced in this episode. We've got work to do on it. Okay, fair enough. But the sublime versus Freud's notion of the uncanny, which ties into a whole world of literature and mythology, and then a very pedestrian notion today of the other, So we've got a triad that we could break down over. I think maybe t like a nice weekend workshop.
Break Lacan on the wheel. Completely take his idea of the other out and say all of that is bullshit because the other is still you. There is no big other. Kant already figured that out with the sublime, that like the little other, the big other, it doesn't matter. It all relates to you. The sublime does not, and that is why it's important.
Let's take this on as a challenge. I think this would be really fun that you and Rios and Lisa could join me. We could do the hot tub scene in Iceland and do a great 2-day workshop, have a real intro hit and then a little bit of a follow-up. I think that'd be really great. I think this is a really interesting idea. I mean, we've got the sublime, the uncanny, and the other. No one else is, could do that better than we could.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And I do think that the uncanny is a nice middle ground for that. Because the uncanny can be reproduced in online spaces 100%. It often isn't, but it's that bridge between this idea of the other, which we've been spoon-fed thousands upon thousands of images of the other for the past 15 years and counting, to no great effect, to just becoming more and more self-absorbed. While the sublime gets pushed further out, but maybe there's a bridge there with the uncanny and the liminal, right? You can see there's a very popular YouTube series called The Backrooms, which is basically people exploring dead malls and strange hallways. Although it's very curated. It's very cur it's it's
Ruined
not
porn.
it's not real. But there's something to that. There's a place that people are trying to get to. They're on the launch pad and they're looking for something. What they're looking for is the sublime, which can, unfortunately for them, only really be found by getting off your ass and going out into the world and finding it, because it's not reproducible within this kind of space. This is huge for me because we've just found what the actual limits of the internet are. The internet cannot reproduce the sublime.
Well
Social
said.
media cannot reproduce the sublime either. And people are slowly dying because you can find this. I went to the Wichitas. They're not impressive mountains or hills or rocks or whatever you want to call them, but you still feel that sublime when you take in one of these vistas. And you can't do that. And I would venture to say, my bold claim is that you will never be able to do that. That it's impossible to do that.
Well, I like that idea, and I think we should really explore this because I really would love to do a focused sort of workshop thing that we could videotape and then really expand on. And I love the idea that we've got a real spectrum here of the sublime, the uncanny, and the other. And I think we could have a great reading list. And I think we open up a lot of channels of thinking that that people would really enjoy today, that are both intellectual and artistic, but not too, not too, I mean,
Absolutely.
Lovecraft is accessible. I mean, these are things that people can get access to, that they can deal with. And I love this idea. I really I nothing would excite me more than to do like a really focused workshop thing over 2 days that in a fun place like Esalen or wherever. But I think this is a really, really good idea. I like it.
Well, good. I'm super. This is a huge eureka moment for me, this episode was, which happens, I feel like probably every 4 or 5 episodes, we really stumble on something really. Oh, and by the way, I want to point out to listeners that we only got through well, no, you did actually cover a lot of this stuff in there, but I only read the first paragraph. But
Well, there's more. So no, we always have more in the tank. I think that's our promise to listeners, isn't it, David? We've always got more search, because we're
That's when
curious
you know we're on
cats.
something. That's when you know we're on something, when we get one paragraph in and we're just cooking. We just get in the kitchen and start cooking. You want to hear my
I
space story?
do. I really want to know where this space expedition is going.
Well, this one is less wacky. Okay, this one doesn't have any gore. I really do think this would make a nice, quiet novella. This is about a novella length story. So, first of all, not really relevant to the story itself. Well, no, it is relevant, but I added this back in. I added that everybody who engaged in this, actually, at a certain point, the hackers could only go so far. And people had to choose, right? Because I wanted to bring up this idea of the fascism of knowledge and the fact that they
Oh,
had
that's a
been,
nice term.
yeah, they'd been given this Western society education. And when they were presented with a choice, do you want to keep doing this or do you want to watch The View for the rest of your, trip? Almost all of them pick it, except for one. So, they land on a planet with an Earth-like atmosphere. The viewers of The View have come to believe that roundtable discussions are of value in and of themselves. And so they assemble a tranquilized assortment of bizarre, dripping alien life to act as a live studio audience to react to the issues that they talk about. The audience is electroshocked to produce response, applause, boos, cheers. They all have electrodes all hooked up to them, these slimy Lovecraft creatures. The Law and Order people send teams out to interrogate the landscape, putting alien life forms in rooms and questioning them on cases that barely make sense, even to themselves, let alone the mucus-dripping life forms that they have chosen to interrogate. But there is one passenger who wakes up from this fugue state who did not choose to engage in either one. He hasn't been turned on to either of the shows, and he is, by and large, a normal human being. But he finds himself completely isolated in the ship, unable to explore the landscape due to his inability to understand his co-passengers. Now, here's where it gets Philip K. Dick and weird, and why it would work better as a long short story or a short novella, in my opinion. I would want to have his diary, and I'd want to have the back half of this be sort of epistemological, not epistemological, epistolary in nature, where he goes insane and realizes that through this hacking experience, he has discovered the true mind of God. Because what shows have God been watching? What rules is God playing by? He realizes that
Whoa.
human beings are dealing with God the way that these alien life forms are dealing with human beings. There's only one God in his estimation, but that God has been filtered through perhaps eons and eons of the most base level shit. So that's the story.
Oh my. Well, I think you did a really, really good job there. And I want to point out a few things to listeners that, I really grow more and more confident in these exercises as a teaching, learning, sharing approach to life, language, imagination. And I, David's willingness to embrace and just flow and just improvise and just riff on all of whatever it gets thrown him is so exciting and refreshing. And I'm starting to see this in some of my own current students, which is a curious batch because I'm definitely dealing, as I think many people in the teaching game are, with some COVID backlash of real difficulties. And I'm reminded how excited they are to get these challenges and to deal with these intersections of possible sharing. Sharing is the idea here, people. This is not just about, and I think this is a way to think about music, soloing, riffing. It is a kind of expression of personality and individuality, I guess, but it's also about sharing. And I've really gotten a lot of sustenance back in the last week or so. I have a woman, a young woman, a small woman in one of my classes, and I think she's one of the most exquisite female creatures I've ever seen. And I was pleased to learn that I'm not entirely mistaken in that idea that she was runner up for Miss Hawaii, and she's a surf champion, and I'm not hallucinating her female intensity, but she's a really good writer. She's also willing to engage, and that whole group that in that one class, they're really, really interested in engaging in these kinds of imaginative challenges, games, explorations of mind. And I think David is performing this in a really important way. It's a vital part of my whole teaching methodology. David explores that in his own teaching. We just support this. It's just fun. This is how we support each other, of being imaginative together, game playing. Playing is the key thing, I think. So that was really cool. I really enjoyed that. And there's more coming your way. And I have to say that as we near our 200th episode, I have something that is just a showdown, an Osborne showdown for 200, but we're closing in. So, bravo.
Sounds good.
Bravo.
Sounds good. Thank you so much. I'm glad you liked that. Do you have a tool and a tip for us today?
I have a major tool. I call it inside outing. Again, a lot of my tools really relate to language reconfigurations, looking at conceptual categories. And I have mentioned this before in earlier episodes, but I really want to focus on it now. I want you to think of the idea of stress. You know, we use that term in a real range of situations. Stress is, on the one hand, something that is external, applied to us. You know, we're dealing with stress from outside. And yet, stress is also more often, statistically, talked about in terms of our experience of it. So we've got a cause and effect problem there. Is stress something outside? Or is it the psychic, physical experience of that? I want people to really think about this very carefully. And to do, David and I often talk about the value of a very fundamental principle of inventory. You know, just making a simple brainstorm, mindstorm list. Think about some words, think about some concepts that flip this constantly inside and out. Stress, I think, is a really good example. I know some people very close to me who just talk about stress all the time. And yet they're constantly switching it backwards and forwards. They're
Yes,
wanting me to
yes.
validate that they're under this external pressure, like wind or storm or rain. Or Oklahoma, you know, tornadoes,
Right.
you know, but really what they're talking about is something completely private to them. And we need to really think about cause and effect is the weirdest dichotomy interrelationship there is in all of existence and all of language, certainly all of Western culture. We need to constantly pull that apart because I don't think that it's a really good sound system. And I think we buy into a lot of programs that go, yeah, cause and effect. You're under stress, David. You've got a toddler, you've got bills to pay, well, yes, of course. Does that necessarily mean that you're clenching your teeth and pissing yourself when you go to sleep? Maybe not, maybe not. So cause and effect is something we need to peel apart on every level. This is a big tool, but I think it really is about inside versus out. That's my approach to it.
That's a very unique twist. Maybe not twist even, but lost explorerization of stoicism.
Yes.
It's a very
Well said.
stoic idea. It's the idea that a cause does not necessitate an effect, especially when that effect is controlled by you. You don't have to feel any type of way about anything. And I think that, oh man, this is a big idea night. But I'm now seeing the connection between a materialist worldview, where cause and effect is drilled into our minds from a very young age, with the mental states of a lot of our fellow citizens. Of course, I'm this way. Look at all the causes.
Yes,
Why wouldn't the effect look like this? But wait.
that's the trick. Yep.
Stimulus and response, maybe. But
Well,
cause and effect?
it's behaviorism. You know, I mean, this is
Yeah.
the thing, is that the whole materialist science thing program from Aristotle, you know, that misnomer, all the way, it gained so much ground, unfortunately, in the B.F. Skinner behaviorist thing of tropisms and response. I'm going to put some acid or some salt on the banana slug, and it's going to, like really freak out. But that's not maybe the way the whole thing should be thought of.
And that's what you are taught when you read Stoic philosophy. It's something that you can add to your praxis, is that when you experience a stimulus, you step back for a moment and realize just how in control of your response you actually are. It's not cause and effect. It's not, oh, a bill is due, therefore I feel this way. It's, oh, a bill is due, and I get to choose how I feel about that. I'm in that mode right now, honestly, man. With a lot of stuff, I just refuse to be stressed about it. I see my
Well, it's
coworkers run around
beautiful
like little,
attitude.
yeah, I see my coworkers running around with, like chickens with their heads cut off and complaining, and I don't know, just doesn't bother me. Should it bother me? I guess you could debate whether or not that's the case, but it doesn't, and it won't. So there it
Well,
is.
I think one of the Lost Explorers' ideas and hopes for our radio community is that people realize they have a little bit more sovereignty about response. Perhaps it's not ultimate, but at least it might be in terms of timing that you just go, look, I'm going to put that off. Simple things like maybe bill pay. I'm going to do all of that on one day. I'm not going to just constantly deal with these things coming out of nowhere. I'm just, no. There's some leeway there, and just taking a little bit more control of our lives. That's our theme, That's pretty basic, and I think it's pretty healthy,
Absolutely.
Okay, here's the tip. And I like this because I think it's something that's really, really relevant today. The idea of the icon and the emoji are eroding language, sense, and depth and structure of thought. I think that a lot of people would agree with that. I think you would. On the other hand, what if we lean into the icon and the emoji? And I want to give you an example. I just ran a workshop where we were looking at the nature of memory versus projection into the future. And I asked people to just do a little drawing to think of it as really, brutal icon terms. Well, memory came up, not surprisingly, as a rear view mirror. And planning, projection, thinking about the future came up as a kind of spyglass or telescope. And I think that has really helped my thinking about memory and projection and forecast. I've drawn a lot of interesting inferences from that. I think that sometimes we should just get out our pencils and pens and maybe try to symbolize, because we can't do the emblematic thinking, as we've talked about, is something very different and really rich and complicated and something we discover. But I think we can symbolize and we can imagize and maybe give ourselves another perspective on what we're thinking about. And so while I oppose a world of icons and emojis, and I just think, oh, fuck, I do think actually leaning into that is not a bad idea. And maybe leaning into what you resist is maybe always an interesting, judo move,
It is interesting, especially if we think about the symbols as hobo code, which we've talked about on the show before. I ever told you what this tattoo represents on my arm?
No, you haven't. And I haven't seen that, I don't think.
Okay. So for listeners, it's a kind of squished soccer ball. Everybody who sees it points at it and says, "Is that a soccer ball?" And I tell them, "Yes," because I don't want to explain what the tattoo actually means. My grandmother passed away about 8 years ago now when I was living in Portland, and she and I were very close. In terms of family members, that was probably the one that I was the closest to, the one that I talked to multiple times a week, the one who I feel the most connected to, sort of genetically, right? She got me, and we'd always been close. So when she passed, I took it really hard, and I was just in a funk, and I couldn't get out of my funk. And so I decided to take a bunch of acid and go out into the woods by myself. And so I did. I ate a bunch of acid, like a lot of acid. And when I got out far enough in the forest park of Portland, which I'm sure you've hiked, Cameron must have taken you there if nobody else did. But
I know what you mean, yeah.
I experienced a kind of strange vision in which I was seeing the canopy of trees and the stars beyond it, but these gods were looming over it, these animal-headed gods. And these animal-headed gods had my grandmother's soul floating between them. They had their arms outstretched, and her soul was floating there. And her soul looked like an egg, but also kind of a fractal, straight, like it would be really hard for me to draw, for example, the way that this pink egg looked like, this hot pink egg. And they put it into a hole in the ground at my feet. And that was symbolizing to me that she was being reborn somewhere. So I sobered up a little bit, like you do when you're on acid. You're not fully out of it yet, but you're good enough to function. And I said, I got to get this symbol tattooed. So I Googled it and I drove to the closest tattoo shop, which also happened to be a fried chicken restaurant. It was a fried chicken restaurant with like a tattooist in the corner. And I showed him that picture, and that's what was drawn on my arm. And it did kind of come out looking like a deflated soccer ball. But I kind of love that, the profundity of the experience mixed with the kind of crass, cheap looking image that's on my arm. That really worked for me. But the reason why I was reminded of it was because while you're giving us this tip about sort of creating your own symbols for things and how those symbols are naturally going to be degenerated from what's in your head or what you've seen. As you were saying that, I crossed my arm over the screen and I saw that tattoo. And I thought that would work as a relevant example of symbolizing your own inner truth in a way that can only be messy and human and a little fucked up looking.
I think that's well said, and I think that should be our thumbnail for this episode. I think it also goes some distance, and you are very articulate. Not explainer or advocate, but I don't know, perhaps just an exemplar of tattoo culture. And I think that it connects with a lot of people, and it is a very strange phenomenon where I think today a lot of tattoos and the mechanisms and sociology behind them go a little bit strange. And maybe we need some sort of sheepdogging. And you were a great sheepdogger back into a frame of reference that I think many people can understand. So I like that as a, I've never seen that before. I don't know why, but it's because it seems quite vivid and fairly large. Vivid and large, what a great way to say anything. But I think that should be maybe the thumbnail for
Can make
this
that the
episode.
thumbnail.
I
Yeah,
like that, David.
of course. I feel like that's a good segue into dream. How's the dream life been treating you?
It's been really, really intense. I had a very strange, in my whole dream record across the years, this is unusual. I've had many situations where I've had sort of gypsy encampments and home invasions and various kinds of infiltrations of my personal space. But this was very odd. I had a really large group of adult people, kind of dumpy looking white people, who didn't look like a family, but I recognized as a family. And it made me wonder if they might have been part of some religious cult. But they descended on my house here in Boulder City in significant numbers. And I initially thought there were like maybe 10 of them, but then I began to think, well, maybe there were more because they kept appearing. And they were there to pressure me in some strange way, and I wasn't quite sure exactly what I was being, what the call to action was. But I had been mentioned in some will or some kind of financial papers by Tom Hanks. Now, this is interesting because I keep a really close record of celebrities in my dreams. One of my assertions in my book is that celebrities actually appear in dreams far less than we might suppose, given our exposure to them in waking life. And we should be very, aware of when they do. And Tom Hanks, I think, is an interesting choice here. And that ties in with a piece of writing I'm doing now about celebrities versus stars. But these people were pressuring me in a weird way of like, I had to do something, and then I would get some money. And it was kind of a con job. And I couldn't really get rid of them. There were so many of them, and they were not the kind of an infestation sort of style dream. Usually the units are smaller. They can be insects or kind of more derelict people. These were kind of middle class, dumpy white people. But and I kept thinking, how many cars did they arrive in? So that was one aspect of it. Then a transition to a very high-ceilinged apartment, two floors, kind of like a European sort of style place. I'd gone up to the bathroom and I discovered that in a white small clawfoot bathtub, someone had pooped in the bath. And I called my ex-wife, my main major marriage ex-wife, up. And then this is what was interesting. I noticed that a three-ring binder of mine had been ransacked, and that pages referring to a dream had been taken. This is very unusual in all of my dream records, where a dream within a dream gets talked about. And I remember that the notes of the dream that I thought had been stolen by someone who'd presumably pooped in the bath had talked about my father as a great green hunter in a mythic sense, and my mother as a red woman, not a scarlet woman, but a red woman. And I'd
No.
made further
Yeah.
notes about the distinction between red and scarlet. Now, in almost 4 decades of dream recording, it is very, very unusual in my personal, private, intimate experience to have language record of another dream involved. So I thought that was a strange thing. And then I came out of that experience walking down a rural road back into my kind of urban into rural anxiety thing. And some machine tractor was coming up the road. And I thought, oh, here we go. And it seemed really like aggressive and strange. And I thought, oh, I'm back to these, this strange anxiety thing of, and it turned out to be a nice Asian woman with a really funky hat. She was just driving a tractor, and she was leading two miniature Highland cattle. Do you know what those look like?
I
Scottish
do.
Highland cattle?
Oh,
Yeah, they're
yes.
hairy and they're kind of, but they were miniature. And she was really friendly. And we were then beside a creek, and a bunch of Northwest Indian stuff was floating in the water. And she thought she had to go get it, and she did. And then she reached out her hand for me as if it was just assumed I was going to take it. And I thought that was a lovely way to wake up. Assume someone's going to take your hand, have a little confidence, faith. She gave me a good feeling. She wasn't a sexy woman. She was cute in her hat, though. She was like the kind of woman you might see working in a botanical gardens in the city,
I am actually going to cut the episode right when you say that was a great way to wake up, because I really like that as an ending point. So I'm going to stop it here.
Cool.